Thüringen, who's going to speak about spectral dimension of quantum geometry.
Thanks. So I want to present some work on the spectral dimension of quantum geometry.
You might have to speak up a little bit.
Excuse me?
Speak a little bit louder, please.
Okay. So I'm going to talk about some work done in collaboration with Gianluca Taipani and Daniele Oriti on the spectral dimension of quantum geometry. So let's go to the motivation on slide 2. The main interest in spectral dimension, generally speaking, is as an observer of quantum geometry. So it's an important general goal to characterize the geometric meaning of quantum gravity states and of quantum history and new quantum gravity in spin form or Zuse theory description. And the spectral dimension is one such possible observable. It's taken by an expectation value of the heat trace, which implicitly describes the geometry of space. And as such, it's an indicator of topology and geometry, and turned out to be a good tool to compare various approaches to quantum gravity as well, actually. There are results in causal dynamics with triangulation and asymptotic safety with our Lipschitz gravity and commutative field theory, even some arguments in quantum gravity already as well, and many more. And it also turned out to have interesting features there, such as, for example, dimensional flow, which is an interesting question as well to look at in quantum gravity. If there is a dimensional flow and other structural structures, then one might even aim at effective descriptions in terms of structural QFP and intermediate regimes. So quantum gravity is special in that here we have a combination of discreteness and additional geometric data. So our heat kernel on the network is in terms of a certain discrete Laplacian, which is different to the approaches so far. And an interesting question then on top is how actually features of discreteness and geometry and of the quantum such as positions interact. So let's start and go to page 3, where I give you an outline of the talk. I will start with the definition of the spectral dimensions in general and in the discrete, for which I have to explain a bit more on the Laplacian discrete geometry, and then present you the notion of quantum spectral dimensions, which I will take here. Then I will talk about properties of the classical spectral dimensions in regarding topology and geometry, as well as discreteness effects. And then I finally go through the actual analysis of quantum spectral dimensions for coherent states, for superpositions of geometry, and for superposition of combinatorics, and wrap up with the summary and outlook. So let's go, let's start with page 4. So the spectral dimension in general is to express information about geometry, as said, in particular by a scalar test particle, and more precisely by a heat kernel, which is the solution to a heat equation. And in this context, one can also alternatively take the interpretation of the heat kernel as the probability of the test particle to go from point X to point Y on some fictitious time scale in the diffusion parameter tau. On the Riemannian manifold, there's an expansion around the flat phase, as described here. So the path before the sum is the solution to, for the flat phase. And then one has an expansion described by geometric coefficients Cn and powers of tau to the n. And it's then the trace of the heat kernel, which apparently could be taken as a return probability, from which one can see that the scaling in the flat case is just taught to the minus d half, and one can define in the spectral dimension or the notion of dimension as the scaling in more general terms on any geometry, which is then governed by a sum of geometric global coefficients. So we get an explicit definition of the spectral dimension as a logarithmic derivative of the trace. Let's go to slide 5. Where we now look at the definition in discrete geometries. So the point is that so far, in the literature, people have either dealt with the purely combinatorial case, such as in causal dynamics of triangulation, where the Laplacian is basically an object of adjacency matrices, or in a smooth setting, where one directly gets the spectral dimension from some advanced Persian relation. Both is not that directly attained in Lucasian gravity, where we have discrete geometry. So we use so-called discrete exterior calculus to get a proper definition of a heat trace in spectral dimension in this case. And the result here is that one can have a definition, a precise definition of the Hodge-Laplace Bertrami operator as in terms of differential V and co-differential delta acting on any p-form on abstract centrifugal or also fully hedral complexes when they have a geometric interpretation, which is an assignment of volumes to the simplicity. And the case interesting for us is the Laplacian on zero scalar fields. So in the picture, the geology is here, the dashed letters. And what you see here is the action of Laplacian on a field evaluated at some north n, which then given by a sum over nearest neighbors with some coefficients in terms of volumes around the north end, volumes of the adjacent faces between N and M, and the length from N to M. Now I want to explain this a bit more in detail on the next pages. So let's go to page 6. So what we need here, what we define in the first place is discrete field spaces. So our discrete space time again is precisely speaking, an abstract finite simplicity complex K with some manifold properties, which are crucial to actually having a definition of a combinatorial dual star K and the geometric interpretation. So all kinds of volumes attached to the various simplicities, simplicities for various P from 1 to D in general. And then we can have a bracket formulation for p-form fields with an orthonormal and complete position base in terms of p-centricities, that's as described here, and we can expand fields in this position space. In general, we speak here to simplicial complexes in the first place only for precise definitions in terms of vertex sets, but our notation is already covered in the more general polyhedral case as well. So let's go to slide 7 for the precise definition, what we actually have put down here. So we consider fields to be cochains. So they're actually forms acting on chains, linear combination of simplicities. And if there is in a cellular decomposition context, one can think of those as smearings over a simplex. But this is not necessary. It works all fine in the abstract case as well. And now the crucial point is that dual fields, so hot dual fields, actually taken to be fields on the dual complex star K. So we define the evaluation of the hot dual of the fields on a simplex to be the evaluation of the fields on zero G minus two simplex, which is then taken to be in the complex conjugate. And finally, we can go one step further and actually identify the primal cochains with the dual chains and the other way around, as it's depicted in the diagram on the right side. And finally, as a consequence, get an inner product directly, just like in the continuum case, as a pairing of primal and touch dual form comes integrated over the home space and the volume measure. So let's go to slide number 8, where I present you how to define then calculus in a fashion in this setting, which is done, the differential is defined directly using Stokes' theorem as a definition. So the evaluation of a P minus 1 form field on a simplex P is just the sum over the evaluation of the field on the boundary of the simplex attached with a some sign and volume factor. And the same can be done for the dual field on the dual simplices as well. And as I already said before, the discrete Laplacian then directly gets the precise definition in the usual sense as d delta plus delta d. And let's go to page slide 9 and again look on the dual scalar Laplacian in this notation now. So it's exactly the same just in terms of the simplices now. And one can check that this Laplacian comes with the desired properties of a null condition and delta jointness, which manifests itself in the symmetry of coefficients in the sum, or the sizability of the overall coefficient. And it's local in the sense that it's only a sum over nearest neighbors, which is directly related to the fact that the Laplacian is a second order differential operator. And we've also shown that for cellular decomposition, absolute manifolds and can also obtain a convergence to continuum Laplacian and Laplacian under refinement. So this is slide number 10. So for the explicit context of quantum gravity theory, we actually have to express the needed volume factors in terms of the degrees of freedom or variables that you're using. So we have given the explicit expressions in edge length on the d minus 1 phase normals or in 4 dimensions in phase 5 vectors, fluxes, or in area angle variables. They're basically applicable to all interesting cases. And by this, you have only some freedom in choosing the dual volume, which for the shared Laplacian is basically needed for the dual edge length, because when one motivates a definition of volumes in a simplistic setting, one could either use polycentric or circumcentric dual volumes, as sketched in the figures here. And it turns out that from the properties demanded of a Laplacian, one might prefer the polycentric view, which we will do, because only then it's ensured that the Laplacian has a positivity property on all generic geometries, which you already can see from the picture here. On the right side, in the circumcentric case, it might happen that the circumcenter lie outside the simplices, and if that's the case for neighboring simplices, then dual edge length, for example, can also be negative. Just for the definition. That's a positivity. So let's go to page 11. The last step for the evaluation of the trace is to go to momentum space, which is quite straightforward in the setting of finite abstract complexes, and as the Laplacian is basically a simplifiable finite matrix in its component description. So as long as all the components given by the volumes are finite numbers, which is the case for at least for non-degenerate volumes, one has an orthonormal complete momentum basis in terms of eigenfunctions of the Laplacian. And this is an appropriate basis for functionals of the Laplacian, such as the F in the Heap kernel. And if we evaluate transform now in the settings, then finally the heat trace turns out to be exactly just the sum over the spectrum of the Laplacian of exponentials e to the minus power of lambda. So this concludes the the definition of Laplacian discrete. And now on page 12, I will provide you with the definition of the spectral dimensions in a quantum case. So we take the expectation value on the level of the heat trace, which is similar to the sum in quasi-dynamical triangulation. And then if you take this expectation value, you find when expanding your state in some basis, finally that you get a sum over the base elements and the coefficients of the state, and then the trace is just over the exponential with the expectation value in the base of the Laplacian. Alternatively, as actually done in almost all other approaches, you could think of taking the expectation value directly at the level of the Laplacian as well. This would, in our case, turn out to give a trace over a product of exponentials. And this is actually not defined in, for example, in the Newtonian context, where our Hilbert space covers all kinds of graphs of different size, because just because the product of expectation values of Laplacian on lattices of different size is not defined. We will stick to the first definition. And now let's go to page 13, where we'll line out the particular case we will use for Lucrone gravity state. We'll actually restrict to 2 plus 1 kinematical state, and further to only those graphs which are actually one skeleton of a combinatorial manifold in the and explained above. And then in 2 plus 1 dimensions, so on 2 dimensional space, the edge length operators give a complete set of geometric observables, which the network space diagonalizes. So we can take the edge length Laplacian form and take it as a quantum operator, which basically acting on the network spaces gives a function of the spin. We check that the heat trace in this description is indeed self-adjoint. More particularly, this is the case for an operator ordering of the length squared operator, where the constant C is larger than zero. Otherwise, we would have to exclude degenerate states corresponding to degenerate geometry. But we have done our latest calculations for various cases of B, and we've seen that they do not crucially depend actually on the size of B. So the reason for restriction to the 2 plus 1 dimension, in the first place, is the feasibility of calculation, because when we want to calculate the spectral dimension on larger complexes, the complexity grows exponential with the dimension. So in 2 dimension, we can do, we can get much more results than we have been able numerically so far in higher dimensions. Another reason is that the definition solution is more straightforward because we have a full, we can express Laplacian in terms of a full computing set of geometric operators or other properties that can be circumvented and we can directly look at quantum correction. Okay, so this concludes the first part. If there are any questions, now would be a good time.
Right, so if we look at your last motivation for g equal to 2 plus 1, so I'd like to understand a little bit more. So are the calculations so complicated for g equal to 3 plus 1 that you cannot put them on regular computers right now, or is it that you could do 2 plus 1 very, very quickly, like in a few minutes, and for 3 plus 1 you have to wait for a few days? Or how much more complex is it to do it in 3 plus 1?
So for the 2 plus 1 calculation, we actually will do some approximation anyhow, as I will explain later. And then for the more advanced calculations, we will present it was actually already on the order of, on the time scale of days. So indeed, to get the result of the same quality in three dimensions would be a significant challenge, which could be addressed by advanced numerical methods as well. So I would say it's not a principal barrier, but rather on the level we've got.
Okay, and the second point about the definition of the Laplacian. So in 3 plus 1 dimensions is the statement that there are subtleties, but you understand them and they're under control, or is the statement that there are things to be explored further, even in principle?
In principle, I mean, we have written down the Laplacian in all kinds of variables. So in principle, you could write down the operator as well. And then you would, for example, only have to deal with operator ordering issues in touch. So we just set it aside. Okay, more questions? Okay, if that's not the case, then let's go to part 2. Properties of the classical spectral dimension. Starting with page 14. So we start very basic. With the smooth case here of the circle, and we do it because if we analyze later the spectral dimension of the quantum gravity state, it's important actually to know the various features we can see there, which are just due to topology or later discreteness, and to identify the actual quantum features. So for the circle, one can directly get a closed expression for the trace, and then one can see that a typical topology effect is due to the compactness, one gets a fall off to zero of the spectral dimension plot, as you can see on the right plot, which can be easily understood. Such as in the return probability picture, in terms of that the particle after diffusion time scale of the size of the manifold will almost fully return, so the heat rate will turn constant and the x dimension will turn zero. And this is very important for the network actually, because so far we basically it's hard enough to deal with finite ones. There's not much known about infinite networks. And the geometry in this very simple case basically just sets the scale where the fall off happens. If we now go to slide 15 and generalize the circle through the parallels, which is still possible in closed form, then we see that if all the geometric parameters, the radii, are equal, it's really just the default generalization of the circle. topics, the radii are of different order, one actually can see what one would expect, namely dimensional reduction in the classical usual sense of compactification, namely that a particle running around the torus won't see at a certain scale dimensions which are compactified on smaller scales. Which in the plot you can see one example. Okay, let's go to page 16, where I have a short example of spheres. For spheres, while for the torus we below the scale of the topology effect, we actually got a plateau of the topological dimension. This is not true for the spheres for larger dimensions anymore. There we can obtain the topological dimension only in the limit of diffusion time going to zero. And the shape of the slope is slightly depending on the dimension. So we see here a geometry effect due to the spherical shape. Let's go to page 17, where we'll now start to explain discreteness effect. So the most crucial discreteness effect actually is a fall off at the larger scale of the spectral dimension to zero. So in the small diffusion time regime, and in the plot you see with a straight curve, state of an infinite lattice. And dotted in dash, you see the spectral dimension of finite lattices. And one can see that they actually these really converge to the infinite case. And we see that to get a plateau, to actually get a regime where we get the topological dimension, we need lattices large enough. Such that there is such a regime in between the discreteness effect and the topological effect. Let's go to slide 18, because ultimately for the kinetics we are interested in triangulation. And already here we haven't found any analytic solution so far. So we start explicit calculations. So we define abstract complexes for torus triangulations in terms of standard triangulation of the lattice, and we have to numerically compute the Laplacian as described by the critics to the calculus and diagonalize it to get the spectral dimension eventually. And you basically see very similar results as for the hypercubic lattice, only this discreteness artifact where we have a peak at a height above the topological dimension is slightly different to the hypercubic case, but then the plateau and the convergence behavior is just the same. From the right side, I always provide a complementary picture of larger triangulation. Namely, if I rescale the edge length such that the overall length scale is 6, I can understand them as a refinement limit as well. So they're actually approximating the smooth torus. This works well for this kind of radial triangulation. Let's turn to page 19, where the same is aimed at for spheres, but actually for spheres we only have as equilateral triangulation a tenth boundary of Stefanik solids, and as you can see here for tetrahedron, octahedron and icosahedron, they're much too small even to have a peak at the topological dimension. So as already expected from the former plot, you see that these triangulations are too small to with any interpretation of dimension, and the the most radical case for sure is the dipole, so the triangulation of the sphere in terms of just two syntheses, which turns out to be independent of topological dimensions. There's always a spectral dimension, which is only peaking at the value of about 1/2. So the lesson of the last slide is really that to have a concept of spectral dimension as dimension, one needs complexes large enough. And this is also the case, often, this is the reason why calculations eventually turn out to be more complicated and really time-consuming. So in the following, we will stick to the toroidal triangulations lattices for this reason. But I want to show you on page 20 one more aspect. If I actually take the torus and take the triangulation of it and subdivided it by Tuffnermuth, then I get even more features. So on the left side, you see the subdivisions by Tuffnermuth on all triangles simultaneously in the combinatorial sense, so with all edge length the same, which actually doesn't triangulate anymore the flat torus, but it's some non-trivial geometry. And you see that we get oscillations around the different value of spectral dimension, namely something from numerical integration 1.37. So here it's not quite clear if this is an effect of geometry or of discreteness, because on the right side you can look at the same Tuffnermuth subdivision, but now we scale all the edges such that it's still a triangulation of the flat torus, but still you see that the topological dimension is not reached anymore, such as in the regular triangulation case. And here it's quite clear that this is only can only be due to the precise combinatorics, which we have used to triangulate. So this example shows that combinatorics themselves already are very important for the extra dimension you obtain, even in the classical case of just one lattice. And finally, on slide 21, I give another example where I've done the same Tuffnermuth substitution, but not simultaneously on all triangles, no, but randomly. And in the on the left side, for the equilateral case, it's basically washing out of the oscillations, but still somehow similar. On the for the rescale case, we even lose any seem to lose any plateau which we had before, as we get a very much smaller plateau and a lower falloff. So the lesson here is really that the combinatorics of your complex really matters for the result of the spectral dimension. So let's go to slide 22, where I want to shortly summarize these results. So we have seen that the large-scale behavior is basically governed by the topology effect, the small-scale behavior by the discreteness effect, and we need an intermediate geometric regime for a concept of dimension. And the dimension in itself depends not only on the geometry, but also on the combinatorics. One could take the cases considered so far already in some sense as quantum, namely these discrete geometries in most cases could be related actually to pure spherical space. So in that sense, this already gives as an exploration of the combinatorial structure some analysis which could be understood as quantum and so on. This concludes the part two. So if there are any questions.
Johannes?
And let's go.
Yeah.
have a question. Could you discuss what you mean by the note connection data? The geometry is already concrete.
Okay, this might turn out nicely explained in the form section further, but Bruce is saying if we evaluate the Laplacian or the heat trace on a spinetic state, we exactly get the Laplacian on a discrete geometry according to the length spectra of the spinetic state. So for a pure spinetic state, the excitation of a pure spinetic state will suggest an evaluation of the spectral dimension on the corresponding discrete geometry.
Is it true for like any gauge group, or both the Lorentzian gauge and the Stephen gauge?
Okay, so here we really refer to the Stephen gauge and SU2, to the spectrum. But for this argument, actually, this would be even more true for continuous spectra, because then with pure states you would obtain all kinds of discrete geometries. While for SU2, with this spectrum, you only get a discrete geometry in a double sense, so also with discrete values of the length.
Okay, thank you. One more question. For those of us who are not in the game, I would like to understand what you mean by combinatory. Do you just mean subdivisions or the way that discretization is carried out or what? I mean, combinatorics of what matters?
Exactly. So the precise example here was various triangulations of the same smooth geometry, but with different combinatorial structure. So at first I showed these more regular triangulations, which really approximated the topological dimension to their spectral dimension. And then later I showed the subdivided triangulation, in particular the random subdivided triangulations, and they gave significantly different spectral dimensions. This was the basic point.
Is the statement that the continuum limit is achieved kind of at different rates for the different subdivisions, like for example the two that you just pointed out, is that what one is saying here, or are you saying that?
That's true. I mean, I haven't made any claims on the infinite triangulation or infinite refinement cases here, as I have been able only to do these numerical calculations on finite sizes. But from these results, one definitely would conjecture that in these limits, one would obtain different dimensions.
I see. So it's not a matter of just that you would get the continuum dimension at different rate. That is to say, you have to do much more refinement. But really, no matter what refinement you do, you would get different dimension if you use one scheme versus another scheme. That's what your expectation is.
Exactly.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, then let's go to the first main part, the analysis of the quantum spectral dimension. And let's start with slide 23. So now we really want to look at quantum states, and especially to explore with a notion of quantumness, dependent of the spectral dimension on the quantumness of space. So the first thing to do is definitely to look at coherent states. So we look at states on a given graph, based on on the set of spins, and also on an extrinsic curvature. But when we evaluate this in the classical Gaussian in the semi-classical regime, actually the phase factor due to the curvature drops out, and the expectation value of the heat trace turns out to be basically a Gaussian, some of a Gaussian distribution. So the goal here is to first also to check that it's in these semi-classical states, also on the regarding the spectral dimension, and on the other hand to identify quantum corrections. And the challenge, as I already explained before, is the size of the sum grows exponentially with the size of the complex, or with the number of links. Even if we would take a cutoff on the spin, but I mean even more so if we don't and only have the effective cutoff due to the cross-quantum conditions on the node. So for this reason, we implement these calculations by approximations by doing a sum over some samples, some random samples, according to the measure which is effectively used in which is effectively the computation value of the heat trace is described by. So here is Gaussian. And on the right hand side you see the result for various values of spins. Here all spins taking the same on all edges. So we are peaking, we want to peak at the equilateral, regular equilateral triangulation of the force. And as you see already, there's only very small deviations. So let's go to slide 24, where I give you the plot of the difference of the expectation of the quantum spectral dimension to the classical case, which the covariance is speaking at. So we see first that it's indeed very close to the case T-set. So the semi-classical behavior is very good. And the deviations are only of order 10 to the minus 2. So, and maybe I have to say it more clearly here, that it's really what we identify here now as quantum corrections is not the difference to the topological dimension, but the difference to the classical discrete geometry with the discreteness and topological effect. So we are by this dividing out the set. And let's go to page 25, where we have checked the dependence on the spread and the coherent state. And as you can see, the results are very similar. The deviations, again, are only of order 10 to the minus 2. Well, here, it's a bit unclear, anyhow, how to interpret the quantumness as dependent on the spread, as the most classic case would actually be spread where the state is the uncertainty for intrinsic as well as extrinsic curvature are minimal, while for the spectral dimension of the spatial state, only the intrinsic geometry actually matters. But anyhow, we see that the deviation is very small. So let's go on our search of quantum effects of spectral dimension now to slide 26. So beyond coherent state, one typical source of effect of quantum theory in general is superposition. So one natural idea, furthermore, is to look at superposition of states over various geometries. So we here stick to one graph where the spins are defined on, the states are defined on, but repeat now on various spin configurations. And this approximation now is not only for the spin classical regime, but we also do some approximation on the cross terms in the sum over Brillouin state here. And now, again, as before, there's a difference whether we take on the left side and treat our state as peaking on the same geometry. So we take the various spin configurations just as various levels of quantumness, but still all states are peaked on the same spin geometry, where we can see that, again, the deviations to the geometry peaked on are very small. We find, again, only deviations for the density minus 2. Or, if we, on the right side, look at the position of state indeed peaking at the geometry at power of different scales. There you can see that the effect basically, or the expectation value, is some kind of averaging. I mean, it's not exactly an averaging because the expectation value is taken on the level of the heat trace, and the spectral dimension is only scaling, so it's derivative. But still, or if you do it on a, if you do the superposition of a few lattices, namely in the right plot, the triangulation plotted with a dash and the dotted curve, it looks like some kind of average. The same is actually true if you go to slide 27 and explore superpositions now not in the string, but in the graphs themselves. So we use the Gauss triangulation. And now, because we have seen that the deviations of coherent states are quite small for reasons of numerical feasibility, we actually just take them sharply peacefully, just take single configurations and sum over various triangulations. And again, you can see on the left side, when they are interpreted as fitting the same geometry, some kind of averaging, as well as on the right side, when they are fixed on different scales. Let's go to the next slide, 28, where we have done it not only over a few lattices, but now here over 40. There we can see that the averaging becomes more interesting for large sums. In the sense that here we could start to conjecture about some convergence of the spectral dimensions, especially of the in the geometric regime, for even larger or infinite position sums. But unfortunately, with the technique used here, much larger translations and superpositions are actually not feasible. So let's turn over to slide 29, where I summarize on these results from the quantum. So what we have seen is that for coherent states, the approximation to the classical geometry works very well. Quantum corrections are surprisingly small, and only if we explore the positions of geometry speed or the positions of graph, we get a large effect due to these non-trivial averagings, as I have shown you. So what's work in progress at the moment is to use more refined and other calculation techniques, where we actually have indications that if we take very large dispositions, so of order 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 states in this position sum, in two dimensions, we actually don't be a conversion to topological dimension 2. But the dimension 2 seems to be special in that, because if you do the same for dimensions larger than 2, I wanted to have here, so starting with dimension 3, topological dimension 3, we actually have found we are working on some superpositions where we even can see a flow to be of some ultraviolet to a spectral dimension of 2, independent of dimension. So we're working on this. Another thing we are still working on is to include the spin form dynamics and evaluate the heat trace inserted in a spin form space time. But where new features such as imaginary contributions appear, so it's not clear that the heat trace in that context is observable in the usual sense, but it might turn out rather to be might turn out rather as a transition amplitude in a general sense. So let's wrap up the whole talk. As a summary on page 30, I've told you this is in what sense discrete geometries demand a new definition of Laplacian, for which I've shown you an extension of discrete exterior calculus to discrete common gravity cases. I've shown you a concept of dimension. I've shown you that the concept of dimension actually is only possible to obtain large complexes, and we have developed techniques to compute these observables of space of geometry on large complexes, and found that in the classical state there are good approximations, and so far stronger quantum effects don't show up. And a very crucial result, I would say, is also that the dependence on the combinatorics of space is very dominant. Going to page 31, as an outlook, one thing to do is for sure to look not only at the spatial dimension of space, but also on the space-time dimension, so the evaluation of the insertion of the heat trace in path integrals and spin forms and TFT is a very important next step. But in particular in the case of two-tier theories, where we have to sum over all kinds of complexes as well, it might be crucial to use analytic methods. And one way to do so is to look how to generalize the analytic results obtained in random trees, dynamic simulations, even recently in tensor models, to include some kind of geometric data related to quantum gravity. Another thing one which would be interesting to do is to use discrete calculus for model building of quantum gravity models, and directly on the discrete level, not as discretizations of smooth action. In particular, metacoupling would be interesting, and this also in particular because it would be generally interesting to use a method developed to analyze other geometric observables, because this seems to be really be an important aim to check the geometric and continuum properties, especially of loop quantum gravity state and history, which are much lower in the so far, I would say. Thank you.
Questions?
I have one question. What do you mean in your analysis the non-commutativity of the geometry? Are you taking it somehow into account or just neglecting it?
So far, actually, I'm not sure if I understood the question right, but I thought it was about the non-commutativity of geometric operators, least here. And so the answer would be that we get the so-called disorder calculation in the 2+1 case, where we have a two-set of commuting operators at hand to define the spectrum and then the heat trace. So we have circumvented them so far for reasons of feasibility of calculation. Does that answer my question?
At least, okay, the heat view you are interested, but intrinsically, what would you expect the non-commutativity appears? And hybrid spin networks, as if those are just essentially classical discrete objects. This is true when you take into account the area, for example. But if you look at the length, the lengths are non-commuting objects, and so in doing your computation, you should diagonalize each time your Laplacian, for example, for different configurations. You see what I mean?
Yeah, totally. And indeed, this could be another source of interesting features of the quantum spectral dimension in that case. Especially one might even expect some dependence on operator order, right? It's basically we haven't come farther so far, basically because of the problem that you really have to take these large complexes to see anything at all, and our quantum wolf and already. It's also the reason why I can't present more on symptoms, which I'm working on as well, because there it's even harder to find that information. So maybe new methods have to be developed as well, or have to evaluate on large complexes. On the other hand, I don't know anywhere else there any calculations on such large formulations that have been done before. Okay, thank you.
More questions?
Johannes, I have a bunch of questions which are all related to more conceptual conclusions that you did not emphasize. So I want to understand that I have we understood those things correctly. The first thing is that I don't understand your superposition of coherent state. Particularly if I go to coherent states with different values of J, right? Because in ordinary field theory, so if I take two coherent states which are fixed at two different classical configurations, and I superpose them, that doesn't look anything like a classical configuration.
Yes.
So I would expect that I don't see why it is of interest to superpose coherent states which are fixed at two different values of J's. I mean, what are we trying to conceptually get at by this superposition?
So this is, in many sense, this is a very explorative work. And basically, because we have seen that for the coherent state, we don't see any more surprising results. We've just played around and looked for other states. I mean, these position states, for sure, are in the Hilbert space as well. So we've just tried with some ideas of what of the notion of quantumness, other states, looking for features. But I totally agree that in the first place, such a position, has no straightforward interpretation.
Okay, but on the other hand, the last superposition you considered, which was with different graphs, and you had a parenthetical remark there that the graphs are perpendicular or something like that. If I go to, for example, the slide 28, so you said that the graphs are orthogonal. So that means that they are, does it mean that these graphs are at different locations in some sense?
Sorry, this was just a bit imprecise. So the opposing orthogonality assumes here just the related spin network state. So we assume that the spin network state and different graphs are orthogonal, which depending on the in your definition need not be the case.
Okay, but in that case, I mean, presumably these graphs may or may not overlap with each other. Is it the case that you also consider the possibility that these graphs do not have any overlaps at all?
So you could take two accounts of this. If the first one is to really consider all the graphs here as fundamentally abstract. In that case, you might not consider them as overlapping in any sense at all. But on the other hand, we are actually treating as complexes which are triangulation of a certain smooth geometry. So if you go to an embedded context, for sure, exactly these graphs actually would really overlap because they are basically refinements of each other. So this depends on your interpretation of the state.
Okay, but then if they are refinements of each other, then how could the states, coherent states, be orthogonal to each other? Because coherent states would always have some components. So you're still making coherent states orthogonal to each other by even though you are refining. Is that the claim?
The general starting point was the use coherent state, but actually on slide 28, I say that we actually use only state position which are sharply peaked, don't they? The sharply here really means no contributions other than these states. So in this actual case, we don't have any other contributions. So indeed, here I would say there are really no overlapping states in the sense. That might be interesting as well to look at these. But from the considerations above, typically because it's basically a Gaussian sum, the overlapping, the cross terms can be neglected. Also because we have seen before that the contribution of effect in the spread of coherent states rather marginal. This is not conclusive. It could be that in this particular case they somehow multiply, but it's just some approximation in this case.
All right, thank you. So now the second set of conceptual issues, it really has to do with what you call dependence on combinatorics, which is to say the way you have done the refinement, right? I mean, you can do a regular refinement or you can do a random refinement, and you can use one move or you can do another move to do refinement. And the statement that you explained to us was that the results, your expectation is that the results, even when there is a large number of vertices, if you are approaching continuum limit in some sense, appropriate sense, even then, this combinatorics, the way that the refined lattice, the way that the limit is taken basically, will not agree and will keep a memory of the discrete structures that you used in the family. So if this part is correct, then two questions. One is, then when people in CDT say that they have a spectral dimension and they do the classical De Sitter space, which by which they mean they get a sphere, your statement would probably be that, well, that is true with a certain kind of discretization. But if I took a continuum limit using some other kind of discretization, I would actually get even the dimension, not the dimension of the sphere. Is this what you would say?
this is what I would say, and the point is that in quantum dynamical triangulations, as far as I understand it, they have a definite description of what triangulations are in the ensemble and how they are weighted, right? So they're just doing the straightforward numerical calculation and they find their values. Maybe if you modify the ensemble and actually you see you see even the various faces, right? In the dynamical triangulations, you see that there are faces where the spectral dimension is that of branch polymers, and these faces where it's that of a continuum manifold. I mean, eventually this is how the spectral dimension historically was introduced to the field, because people in dynamical triangulations did exactly this. This observable text on what actually faces there in the ensemble.
Right, but I mean, my general understanding or general qualitative picture was that there are kind of universality classes of refinements, and so you are saying that, if I understand what your results are suggesting, is that in fact it's a very delicate matter that. Different refinements will just give you quite different results, even for spectral dimension. So you have to take the limit in a very delicate way, as, for example, Bianca has been telling us. Is that correct? Is my understanding correct?
Yeah, I would say that, yes.
So the last thing is really then, again, looking at coming back to spin forms, and it is related to this also, about the continuum limit and so on. So your statement again would be that if I just took let me step back one step. That you also had a statement which said that, well, to have a well-defined spectral dimension, one needs a large number of vertices, right? One needs a large complex. So when people take something like, you know, single or few simplices and take large J's and want to say that that is a classical limit, that seems to go against your general picture. Am I correct about this?
This is true. Here in this case, I'm only considering the spectral dimension. So I'm considering a geometric quantity which is defined by an integral over the whole manifold. Right? So in this case, for the spectral dimension, I would definitely say it's true. It could still be that you can extract information from just the local, of certain more local geometric quantities by just looking at, locally at parts of smaller complexes, which you might understand as part of a larger one, and that for those geometric quantities you can. Find all kinds of interesting results. Only for the spectral dimension, indeed, it seems to me, at least from what I've presented, that you really need the large complexes to obtain a proper analysis of spectral dimension at all.
Okay, very nice. So therefore, it looks like there are kind of classes of observables, some which are more global, like the dimension, and then some which might be a little more local. Do you have any feeling, you or Daniele or anybody else, have a feeling as to how to distinguish between them? I mean, what would be good observables for which just a few simplices would be fine, and what would be good observables for which, spectral dimension being one case, for which in fact you need a lot of simplices? I mean, do you have any feeling, understanding of division between these observables?
From the analysis we've done so far here, this really only gives hint at the global cases. So I wouldn't know how to break this down. I mean, only for such a global object, you can see from the finite calculations at which level you start to be able to tell anything. Like when you have the geometric regime, it was typically the case at lattice size of 10 to about 10 to the 3. So But then to speculate about other observers which need smaller, only smaller latitude, I don't know.
Okay, so you're saying that conceptually we really don't have a good handle on a distinction between the two types of observables, or at least we don't understand that there may not even exist a class of observables for which much smaller lattice sizes would give you a faithful result. At this stage, everything is not an open issue. Is that correct? I mean, is this compatible with your understanding?
As far as my knowledge goes.
I just want to make a short comment to one of our previous comments on this dependency of the second dimension of the refinement you're taking. So when you were looking into a higher dimensional formulation of the theory, and when you there implement the simplicity constraint, you find that your quantum states, after some subtleties in the diffeomorphisms, are always basically SU2 spin networks. So they carry the same quantum numbers as an SU2 spin network. If you just write down some spin network and consider or try to figure out the spectral dimension, you shouldn't be too surprised if things look weird there, because you're a priori not sure to which dimension it belongs, just considering its quantum numbers, and also considering that, I mean, these heat current things and so forth would look exactly or basically exactly the same in higher dimensions up to some small correction. So,
More questions? Okay, let's thank Johannes again.